Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Center for Science and Culture. The following talk is by Richard Sternberg, a biologist with the Discovery Institute. Dr. Sternberg will be discussing evidence that refutes the myth that the human genome is full of junk DNA. This lecture was recorded at a recent Science and Human Origins conference. Here's Dr. Sternberg.
Here's another example, and this is one that would be, I would say, well, if you're a man, it should make you feel pleased. If you're a woman, less so. But let's assume 99% of our DNA is similar to that of a chimpanzee. For the sake of argument, let's just assume it. Well, it turns out that the Y chromosome for a man constitutes about 2% of his total DNA content. In any one of your cells, your Y chromosome is 2%. When you compare the human and chimpanzee Y chromosome, and this was discovered in 2010, they're highly dissimilar. There's almost no commonality to them. They are markedly species specific. So if you want to do the math, that means that every man here is 2% less a chimpanzee than any woman sitting next to him. If you're going to buy the 99%, sit down and do the math. There's the paper. By that reckoning, unexpected. You would expect by a pattern of common descent, other things being equal, that our Y chromosome would have what? Evolved from the same ancestral Y chromosome that the chimpanzees, and therefore you would expect a high degree of similarity. But whether you look at the bottom lowest level DNA sequences or you work your way up to the highest levels, they're discordant. Again, known. But this is not something that you're going to find on your average reasons to be a happy-clappy theistic evolutionist. You'll never find a citation of it. In fact, I had a conversation. It was a roundtable discussion, and I brought this up. And this was not too long ago. This was 2012, by a fellow affiliated with the BioLogos organization. And I said, well, what about, you say we're 99, what about the Y chromosome? And his response to me, public, was what? Well, there's a striking dissimilarity. How do you explain it? Oh, no. He was completely unaware of it. But it's sitting there. And in the most prestigious journal, you can go on to PubMed, type in human Y chromosome, and you'll find plenty of papers. And even if we assumed that, okay, you've got this big gap, human Y chromosome, chimpanzee Y chromosome, they're very, you know, dissimilar. Who cares? Junk is junk is junk. Here's why. We now know from mouse studies, especially from the fruit fly studies, but also from humans, is that the Y chromosome is one big regulatory element. Here's an example. This shows you a nucleus, and these little colors here is a chromosome. So you see, for example, purple is chromosome 2, the Y there is kind of darkish green, chromosome 6 is an orangish yellow, etc. And of course, there are two copies of each chromosome, except there's one X if you're a male and one Y. And this just shows how they're arranged in, say, a standard nucleus. And it turns out, though, that the way the chromosomes are arranged in the nucleus is very important for what? Male sperm development. And one of the markers, and they're now using this for cows also, if any of you are a rancher, is that how the Y chromosome is folded and how it's positioned in the nucleus, in the cells that give rise to the spermatozoa, is very important for fertility. If it isn't packaged the right way, other things being equal, you have infertility. And with men, as you know, there's been this increasing incidence of infertility. And they look at these patterns. So what they're saying is that this organization, the way they're arranged globally in the nucleus, is an additional layer of information. And now the buzzword for that layer of information is what? Epigenetic. They say, oh, it's epigenetic information. But the Y chromosome also forms a compartment for various proteins within a nucleus. And in the fruit fly, you have a very similar situation. Each species, 2,000 species of fruit flies, each species has its own type of Y chromosome. And if you take that one Y chromosome and you put it into another species, or you can do those experiments easily in a fruit fly, you get just infertility. they will not work on those backgrounds. If you decide that you are going to add a Y chromosome or you're going to cut it in half, it has global effects on male fruit fly development. And that's because it is this massive, if you will, think of it. It's a big chunk of DNA. It binds proteins. It folds up. And so it's this, if you will, it's a sink. It just draws components to it. So even if you were to assume that, yeah, it doesn't code for proteins, and by my definition, therefore, it's just garbage, it's still having this massive regulatory impact. All right, so that's another reason. All right. But perhaps one of the most interesting ways that humans and chimpanzees differ is that we have a process that occurs in every single one of your nerve cells at this moment. As you're listening to me, or not listening to me, you are having, in your synapses, you are having these second by second or millisecond by millisecond changes. You're changing your neurotransmitters. You're changing the receptors. The changes, however, are occurring in this way. They're occurring by a process called RNA editing. Adenosines are converted into a base that you probably haven't seen. You've seen the A's, C's, G's, and T's, but it's a base called inosine with an I. And you say, well, what does this inosine do? Well, it's read by the protein-producing machinery as a G. So it converts an A, basically, to a G. And here's an example that involves a human-specific family called ALU. It's one of those sign elements. It's part of the, quote-unquote, junk fraction. But you've got an editing event that occurs between two of them in a region that doesn't code for protein at all. And this is at the RNA level, so we're above the DNA level. And what happens is this. A change that takes place between two protein-coding regions converts that non-protein-coding region into one that codes for a protein. And so you end up by making the on-the-fly change. It's like an editor coming in and spotting something and saying, you know something, we could insert text. If you just made some changes here, you know, you could make this flow a lot better. You could add more information to it. That's exactly what's happening. But it's happening by an literally on-the-fly editing process. When you compare this process with humans, chimpanzees, and macaques, and we knew this as of 2010, we now know a lot more. I picked this because the graphics are so nice, frankly, but it makes the point here, is that when you look at this editing process, in humans, it's off scale. In chimpanzees, occurs at a lower frequency. When you go to the macaque, it's at a much lower level. When you look at where those edits are taking place, and that just shows you an example, most of the edits are occurring within those ALU families. But when you look at where they're taking place, and this was as of 2010, now there's a lot more, they're mainly occurring in the RNAs that code for the proteins, that code for what? Your central nervous system. So what you are doing is you're taking, if you will, the same conserved data, but you're rewriting it in an almost instantaneous manner, and you're producing a lot of diversity that you don't find in the chimpanzee. So again, even if we are that close, you're doing things with your DNA that a chimpanzee, frankly, is not doing with its DNA, the data notwithstanding. It's striking. It's intriguing. And for me, one of my research programs is asking the question, who's editing the editor? And what is this editor? I mean, come on, you've got to have some managing process there. You know? So when you get past this nice National Geographic 2001, A Space Odyssey scenario, you know, the first 20 or 30 minutes, Kubrick's very lifelike apes taking their next leap forward, what you find is that even if you were to say, our DNA sequences, Rick, I'm sorry, I just buy that we are 99% similar. The fact is we are doing so many things in so many different ways with our DNA that just at that level, we're incommensurable. We're incommensurable. To give you a very crude analogy, it would be like giving, if any of you have had a classroom, you're using the same textbook. Everybody's got the same textbook. But you've got some students there, it doesn't matter. You could lecture to them all day long, and they just don't use the material. You've got other students there, and they'll simply say, you know, I'm learning that, but they're way beyond. So if you will, it's a crude analogy, but it's something similar to that. Even if it were 99% similar, nonetheless, it's being used in a very different way.
This lecture was recorded at a Science and Human Origins conference in the fall of 2014. The conference featured John West, Casey Luskin, Ann Gager, and Rick Sternberg talking about the fossil, genetic, and social issues surrounding the debate over human origins. We will be featuring these speakers on future episodes of ID the Future. For more information, please visit idthefuture.com. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.